Welcome to the Bristol Quayside Adventure, a walking tour based on the Treasure Island Trail. Chapter 1. Walk with us around the harbour, down Bristol's cobbled streets. Let us take you back to a time when the quayside was packed with tall ships loading and unloading cargo.
Illy-ally, illy-ally-o, cheerily, boys, cheerily, bend your backs and give a full, cheerily, I say, with a long pull and a strong pull, we'll haul away together, boys, belay every inch of that, belay, boys, belay.
A time when pirates, privateers, press gangs, captains and sailors worked and dreamed of making their fortunes.
It's treasure we'm after.
Let us tell you about the people, places and stories of 18th century Bristol, which are linked to Robert Louis Stevenson's famous adventure story, Treasure Island. The novel's quayside scenes are set in Bristol, but historians argue over whether he even visited the city. All novelists use their imagination, and this trail uncovers some of the Bristol connections. The Long John Silver Trust have written a Treasure Island trail book, which is available from the Tourist Information Centre at Wild Walk and bookshops. They have grand plans to create a sculpture of Long John Silver and 6 pieces of artwork on the harbourside to bring alive the novel. Bristol Quayside Adventure takes a slightly different route to bring in more of the city's historical connections. Just remember to keep a weather eye out for 21st century traffic as you listen to the tour, and take care over rough cobbles. The walk lasts up to an hour, but you can linger in cafes and inns along the way, stopping the tour to rest your weary bones. Chapter 2. The Merchant Venturers' Almshouses, King Street. From the city centre, follow the signs to the Bristol Old Vic. The Bristol Old Vic is situated on King Street, but we start our trail at the city centre end of King Street, at the junction of Broad Quay and Prince Street. Stand outside a new, modern stone building called Venturer's House. Immediately next door, you'll see an old, low building with a pretty courtyard, surrounded by railings. These are the Merchant Venturers' Almshouses, built for retired seafarers, and they have a lovely inscription high up on the walls. Freed from all storms, the tempest and the rage of billows, here we spend our age, our weather-beaten vessels here repair. And from the merchant's kind and generous care, find harbour here, no more we put to sea, until we launch into eternity. Sailors had a hard life at sea. Accidents and amputations were common, and many skilled one-legged sailors would have ended up with the job of cook, just like Long John Silver in Treasure Island, or perhaps too ill from consumption or tropical diseases to live long. These almshouses were one way that the rich merchants who controlled the city's overseas trade showed their charity. One of the seafarers who died here was William Williams, who wrote The Journal of Llewellyn Penrose, a Seaman, about a sailor shipwrecked in Central America. Just one of the stories that Robert Louis Stevenson may have read. If you're ready to move on, please listen to these directions. Look for the signs to the Bristol Old Vic. Walk past the merchants' almshouses and begin to walk along King Street. Pause the tour and restart it when you reach 2 pubs, the King William Ale House and the Royal Navy Volunteer, which are on your right-hand side. This dockside area would have been packed with sailors and traders in the 1700s. During their heyday, Bristol's inns were renowned for their turtle soup and Bristol milk, which wasn't milk at all, but Bristol sherry. Look out for King William Avenue by the side of the King William Ale House, and imagine it dark at night, with the press gangs waiting outside to forcibly recruit men for the Navy. Spot the dancing sailor on the Royal Navy Volunteer pub sign. Bristol was a leading port in the 18th century and was at one time Britain's second city. It was known for shipbuilding, tobacco, sugar, and the appalling slave trade. See Renato's Taverna dell'Artista on your left, with its crazy sloping door and windows. It's got a collection of signed photographs of famous actors on the walls who have worked in the nearby Old Vic Theatre down the decades. If you go there in the evening, it's still a place to bump into celebrity actors. Chapter 3. The Theatre Royal. From Renato's, it takes a minute or two to walk to the impressive Old Vic Theatre, which dominates King Street. Pause the tour and restart it when you get there. Back in 1764, wealthy merchants put in cash to sponsor the building of the Theatre Royal, now home to the Bristol Old Vic. There was a lot of local opposition, including from John Wesley, the Methodist minister, who complained to Bristol's mayor that drinking, debauchery, indolence, effeminacy, and idleness would become a problem and affect trade in the city. There were 50 sponsors, and each were given a silver token or coin so they and their descendants could see a performance. Seeing didn't mean you got a seat back then. There was lots of standing space, up to 1,000 people could be crammed in, though now there are seats for just 600. If you could find one of those original silver tokens today, the Old Vic would still let you in for free. In the times that Treasure Island refers to, the Old Vic Theatre was a rowdy place, and if you had servants, you would send them ahead of you to keep your place until you arrived in your carriage in style and comfort. Today, the theatre is nationally acclaimed, particularly for its award-winning children's theatre. Behind-the-scenes tours take place regularly on Fridays and Saturdays, and you can hear about the resident theatrical ghost and see the beautiful interior. You just need to book in advance. Chapter 4. The Landogger Trow. From the Bristol Old Vic Theatre, carry on to the end of the street, and you will soon see two more pubs ahead of you, a black and white timbered building on the right called the Landogger Trow, and the Old Duke, Bristol's famous jazz pub. Restart the tour when you are outside the Landogger Trow. You should now be standing outside the black and white Landogger Trow Inn. The novel of Treasure Island starts at the Admiral Benbow on the coast road to Bristol. And looking at the Landogger, it's easy to imagine that this could be the type of pub Stevenson had in mind for the Benbow, and there was a landlord here called Captain Hawkins. The pub was named after the flat-bottom ships, or trows, from Wales, which unloaded on the nearby quayside at Welshback. Apparently, it has three ghosts, including a young lad who lingers on the stairs. The pub claims that Daniel Defoe, the author of Robinson Crusoe, met the rescued sailor Selkirk here, though Defoe denied any meeting. In the fictional Admiral Benbow, the young Jim Hawkins fetches grog for the old sea dog Billy Bones, a man with a terrible burden. Billy Bones is holed up at the Benbow, hiding Captain Flint's treasure map in his chest, but he knows the evil pirate gang is after him. He spends his time on the cliffs and coves with a spyglass looking for ships. He begs Jim to tell him the moment he sees a one-legged sailor, but it's Black Dog who arrives at the inn. He realizes Bones is at the inn and rushes off to return with more pirates. Vicious Blind Pew comes with the dreaded Black Spot in his hand. The Black Spot delivers death to anyone who receives the piece of paper. Billy Bones dies of shock. Jim and his mother find the map in the chest and escape from the pirates in the nick of time. Blind Pugh is trampled to death. Jim shows his rescuers, Squire Trelawney and Dr. Livesey, the map, and they decide to charter a ship and crew and sail off to find the treasure. Chapter 5. Welshback and the Captain's Papers. These directions will take you from the Landoggertrow pub to an area called Welshback. Walk past the Landogger on the cobbled pavement as far as you can go, then cross over the cobbled road, taking care to look out for traffic. Walk straight ahead and find a spot where you can see the water along the quayside of Welshback. Find a viewpoint by the black railings overlooking the water. Opposite you are some 19th century storage warehouses, most of them now converted into upmarket flats or offices. Look out for the large Dutch houseboats on the water, the flock of resident swans, and the Bristol ferryboats taking passengers around the harbourside. This is Welshback, part of the original port of Bristol. In the 17th century, tall ships would have been moored along the whole stretch of this water up to the medieval Bristol Bridge, which is to your left as you face the water. Many merchants and adventurers would have planned their journeys here in the heart of the old quayside. In Treasure Island, Squire Trelawney travels to Bristol to find
the best ship, sir, and the choicest crew in England.
I've been a sailor since my birth.
Yo ho ho and a ruddy bum bum.
Took my ship for all she's worth.
Yo ho ho and a ruddy bum bum. Lime scurvy and the grease and marmalade. Hoist up the tardel, haul away me bully boys. Lime scurvy and the grease and blood.
He makes Jim the cabin boy, Livesey the ship's doctor, and appoints himself admiral. We'll have favourable winds, a quick passage, and money to eat, to roll in, to play duck and drake ever after. In Bristol, Trelawney finds a schooner called the Hispaniola, and on the quayside one bright morning meets a one-legged sailor called Long John Silver, who is very helpful in suggesting a number of sailors ideal for the trip. The squire appoints them, little realizing they are part of Deadly Flint's original pirate crew.
This treasure we'm after.
Somewhere along the quayside here, the Long John Silver Trust would like to see a sculpture of Squire Trelawney, Dr. Livesey and Captain Smollett, busy with the captain's papers, planning their dangerous expedition to Skeleton Island. Chapter 6. Queen Square. We will now make our way towards Queen Square. So listen carefully. Keep the water on your left-hand side. To get to Queen Square, walk along the water's edge by the black railings and continue under the covered walkways as far as you can go until you reach the farthest red brick building. Turn right towards the road, cross over into Mill Avenue and head towards the statue of the Horse and Rider in the centre of Queen Square. Please note there are very rough cobbles, so you may prefer to walk on the pavement by the cobbled road. When you reach Mill Avenue, turn right along the avenue and head for the statue of the Horse and Rider in the centre of Queen Square. Restart the tour when you reach Queen Square. King William III's statue. Stop at the magnificent brass statue of William III on his horse in the centre of Queen Square. The square was named in honour of Queen Anne, who visited the city in 1702. But before the grand houses were built, this area was a marsh used as a bowling green, to graze cattle, for bull baiting, and some say to execute pirates. Queen Square was the heart of the business district of 18th century Bristol, built for the wealthiest merchants, convenient for the docks and the ships they controlled. It is surrounded on three sides by water, though you cannot see the water from the square. If you look in the direction of the Horse's Head, you can see the Customs House, situated here to collect taxes and duties from ships. The merchants also built an American consulate at No. 37 in 1792. Bristol merchants were involved in all sorts of ventures, the two most lucrative being the slave trade and privateering. Privateers had a license or letter of marque so they could legally attack ships from other hostile countries. They could keep any of the golden guineas, doubloons and jewels they captured too. We will now go to the site on Queen Square where Woodes Rogers lived. He was the most famous and successful Bristol privateer. Chapter 7. Woodes Rogers, Merchant and Privateer. Standing with your back to the tail of William III's horse, follow the path to the edge of the square, cross the cobbled road, and halfway up the wall on one of the houses facing you, you will see a blue plaque about Woodes Rogers. Restart the tour when you get there. Captain Woodes Rogers was a privateer, legally permitted to attack Spanish ships in the South Seas and to keep any treasure he found. His Bristol-built tall ships, the Duke and Duchess, set off from the quayside in Bristol in 1708, sponsored by city merchants who had shares in any success. His navigator was William Dampier, a buccaneer who incidentally was the first Englishman to land on Australian soil. When the ships reached the Pacific, they spotted a fire on a deserted island. They found a strange man covered in goatskins, barely able to speak. This was the mariner Alexander Selkirk, who had been cast away 4 years before. They picked him up and carried on to capture Spanish galleons and treasure ships. They captured a fortune, estimated at £800,000 in 1712, and a large share of this was brought back to the Customs House in Queen Square to be shared amongst the merchant sponsors. Woodes Rogers and his navigator William Dampier had travelled around the world and back, but they made little money out of the trip, and the Royal Navy even attempted to press-gang the crew on their return. Both Dampier and Woodes Rogers wrote best-sellers about their adventures, and this inspired authors to write travel stories. Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels is based on Dampier's accounts of strange lands. He even had the hero's ship, the Antelope, set sail from Bristol. The story of the castaway Selkirk inspired Daniel Defoe to write Robinson Crusoe, though he later dismissed Dampier and Woodes Rogers as illiterate sailors. Robert Louis Stevenson would have read all of these books, and Selkirk is linked to Ben Gunn in Treasure Island, the half-mad character marooned by Captain Flint's evil men. Selkirk became a national celebrity on his return to Bristol and sometimes wandered around the streets in his goatskins. Woodes Rogers ended his life as governor of the Bahamas. Chapter 8. The Hole-in-the-Wall Pub. Facing the Woodes Rogers plaque, turn so that the grass of Queen Square is on your left. Find a pleasant spot to stand by the grassy area adjacent to the Hole-in-the-Wall Pub and restart the tour. The Hole-in-the-Wall closely fits the description of the Spyglass Inn. When Jim Hawkins arrives in Bristol, he's told to take a note to Long John Silver, landlord of the pub with a spyglass, and to look out for a little tavern with a large brass telescope for a sign. Jim follows the line of the docks, picking his way through people, carts and bales where the docks were at their busiest. He reaches a tavern with a cleanly sanded floor, a street on each side, and an open door on both. He meets Silver, the wily one-legged sailor with the parrot Captain Flint on his shoulder, screeching, "Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight!" Jim actually spots Black Dog in the pub, but is fooled by the clean and pleasant-tempered landlord, who sends his customers running after the pirate to gain Jim's confidence. Silver calls Jim as smart as paint, and takes him along the quayside, showing him the ships. Silver is employed as the sea cook on the Hispaniola, but of course is a pirate captain intent on stealing Cap'n Flint's treasure for himself and his pirate brand. In the 18th century, many drunken sailors were press-ganged in Bristol and found themselves stone-cold sober at sea the next morning. You can still see the pub's original spy hole, where a sailor would be put on watch to look out for press gangs or the evil slavers. Once the recruiters were spotted, the sailors could make an easy escape onto Queen Square, if they weren't too drunk, that is. To see the spyglass feature, walk to the point of the grassy area so that you are directly facing the front of the pub and stand by a sign saying The Grove. The porch jutting out from the side of the pub facing the restaurants is the famous spy hole, and the narrow windows can still be seen. Chapter 9. Setting sail from Bristol. Now turn around so that you have your back to the hole in the wall. You should see Redcliffe Bridge in front of you, with the tall spire of St. Mary Redcliffe Church to the right of it. The bridge is currently painted green. You need to cross this bridge. To do this safely, there's a pedestrian crossing down to your right, past the spyglass window of the hole-in-the-wall pub. This is a great place to stop off at the cafes and restaurants with views over the water. Restart the tour when you cross the bridge. Immediately over the bridge, you will see an open gated entrance on your right. Go through the gates and walk down onto the cobbled walkway by the water. Take care, as the quayside is unfenced. Walk along the water and find a spot to stop. There are plenty of benches to sit on. Setting sail from Bristol. This area is called Redcliffe Wharf. Jim Hawkins describes a walk along the Bristol quayside. Our way lay amongst the quays and beside the great multitude of ships of all sizes and rigs and nations. In one, sailors were singing at their work. In another, there were men aloft, high over my head, hanging to threads that were no thicker than a spider's. Though I had lived by the shore all my life, I seemed never to have been near the sea till then. The smell of the tar and salt was something new. I saw the most wonderful figureheads. I saw besides many old sailors with rings in their ears, and whiskers curled in ringlets, and tarry pigtails, and their swaggering, clumsy sea walk. The Hispaniola sets off from Bristol with the sailors singing.
15 men on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum. Drink, and the devil had done for the rest. Yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum, but one man of the crew alive. What put to sea with 75?
The song is perhaps based on the story of that infamous Bristol pirate Blackbeard, who marooned a mutinous crew on Dead Man's Chest Island in the Caribbean, a barren outcrop without fresh water. Blackbeard had a sick sense of humour. He gave each man a cutlass and a bottle of rum and left them to their fate. He was amazed when he returned a month later to find that 15 had actually survived. Aboard the Hispaniola and nearing the end of the voyage to Treasure Island, Jim gets in the apple barrel to retrieve one of the last apples and overhears Long John Silver and his mutinous crew plotting to take the ship and the treasure and to kill anyone who stands in their way. Chapter 10. Redcliffe Caves. We will now make our way towards Redcliffe Caves. Follow the walkway around the half-timbered building. You will see some fine Georgian houses set high above some sandstone cliffs. There are a number of cave entrances, but you need to make your way to the bottom of a long ramp and look for the gated cave entrance marked by a blue plaque above. Pause the tour and switch on when you reach the caves. You are now outside Redcliffe Caves, facing a blue plaque. The sloping path up to the street was originally built as a donkey ramp to carry cargo such as sugar, tobacco, cotton bales, lace or wine from the quayside to the road above. On top of the cliffs stand the fine Georgian houses of Redcliffe Parade, now painted in pretty pastels. These houses were home to ships' captains and owners, and their elevated views meant the merchants could keep an eye on their ships coming and going in the harbour. There are still some businesses trading in Bristol from these times, including Avery's Wine Merchants, wine importers in Bristol since 1793. Their historic vaulted cellars storing wine is in the city centre on Culver Street, opposite one of the oldest pubs in Bristol, the Black and White Hatchet Pub. Worth a visit if you're in the city centre. Redcliffe Caves stretch for 3 acres underground, and their dark passageways have spawned stories of smugglers hiding their loot in the dark recesses of the caves. Who knows whether this is true or not? We do know that the cool caves were a good place to store cargo, such as elephant tusks or palm oil, unloaded from Redcliffe Wharf below. The caves were also used to excavate sand for use in Bristol's glass industry, to make rum bottles, no doubt, and also glassware which was traded on the African coast. In Treasure Island, the secretive Ben Gunn lives in a cave and leaps about his hilly island home half mad after 3 years' solitude. He greets Jim with the words, "I'm poor Ben Gunn, I am. Many's the night I've dreamed of cheese. Toasted, mostly." Ben is not as naive as he appears. He keeps a good supply of salted goat's meat. He finds the treasure and stashes it in his cave. Tours of Redcliffe Caves can be booked by groups, and the public can see the caves during Open Doors Day, which takes place annually in September. Chapter 11. The Ostrich. Return to the bottom of the donkey ramp, follow the walkway along, and when you reach the black railings, go round to your left, then stop near to the Ostrich Inn. Rejoin the tour when you reach the Ostrich Pub. The Ostrich dates from 1745, and inside is a cave decorated with ship's ropes and a skeleton. It's said to have been a smuggler's haunt, and with the caves and quayside so close, you can imagine why. You're welcome to have a look at the cave in the corner of the pub, but children under 14 are not allowed in the bar unless they are having a meal in the pub. On the Hispaniola, Jim attempts to rescue the ship from the mutinous pirates. He climbs the mast, chased by Israel Hands, and the pirate falls to his death in the sea. There was a real-life Israel Hands, who crewed for the famous and most terrifying pirate of them all, Blackbeard. Like many villains, the truth about Blackbeard is contradictory. Most historians agree that he was born in Redcliffe, Bristol, though others claim him as their own. Blackbeard was notoriously cruel and raided ships in the Caribbean Sea. If anyone on board resisted, all were killed without mercy. He once shot his own crew. When asked why, he explained, "Damn you all! Unless I now and then kill one of my own men, they'll forget who I am." Blackbeard was a true showman. As well as having 14 wives, he had a long black beard which he twisted with brightly coloured ribbons and lit tapers in his beard during battle, so his head was wreathed in smoke in order to terrify his enemies. He wore a crimson coat, bristling with knives, swords and pistols, and designed his very own pirate flag with a skeleton and a pierced heart. Many ships surrendered as soon as they saw it. Eventually, the Royal Navy was sent to end his reign of terror on the seas. There was a bloody battle, and he died only after he'd been shot 5 times, stabbed 20 times, and then decapitated. His headless body was thrown overboard, and it is said that it swam around the ship 3 times before disappearing. The severed head swung on the ship's bowsprit as proof of his death. Captain Flint is described as being even more of a bloodthirsty buccaneer than Blackbeard. If you want to know more about pirates, local character Pirate Pete can reveal their dark secrets on the Bristol Pirate Trail, which takes place regularly throughout the year. Chapter 12. Return to Bristol. From the Ostrich, cross over the narrow footbridge, turn right along Trin Mills and walk in the direction of the big black boat called the Thecla. Turn left around the corner and walk along by the black railings. Stop at the end of the walkway near to a bridge. This is Prince Street Bridge, and it's a swing bridge. When ships need to pass, the road is closed, the cars stop, and the bridge swings open to let ships through. This is the last stop on the trail. At the end of the novel, Silver takes Jim hostage, and they search for the treasure. The pirates come across a skeleton pointing the way like a compass. They are superstitious and become nervous when they hear Ben Gunn calling, "Dobby McGraw! Dobby McGraw!" thinking that Captain Flint is haunting them, as these were his last words. When the pirates reach the sea chest, they find it's empty. Jim and Silver are rescued by Trelawney and Livesey and find the real treasure in Ben Gunn's cave. "Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight!" The Hispaniola returns to Bristol Port with just 5 men aboard.
Drink and the devil had done for the rest. Yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum.
This is the end of our trail, and you are now in the heart of Bristol's vibrant harbourside. From here, you can easily walk to many of Bristol's harbourside attractions and restaurants. Follow the signs to visit Arnolfini's Art Gallery, the Watershed Media Centre, or at Bristol's interactive science attractions. The Georgian House on Park Street was once owned by Bristol merchant John Pinney, who owned sugar plantations. The museum shows life above and below stairs. To see more ships and boats, cross over the road past the old dockside cranes to see Brunel's famous SS Great Britain, or the replica of the Matthew that John Cabot sailed when he discovered mainland America. Cabot Tower on your horizon to your right was built in honour of the explorer. You can catch one of Bristol's ferry boats for a tour or a view from the water. If you turn right over Prince Street Bridge and walk for 5 minutes, you will reach the starting point of this tour at the bottom of King Street. With thanks to the Long John Silver Trust. If you would like more information on the Long John Silver Trust campaign to create a sculpture trail, visit their website at longjohnsilvertrust.co.uk. Copyright of original sea shanty music belongs to Harry Browns of Bristol. Thanks, boys. Re-recording their music is not permitted. Visit their website at harrybrowns.org.uk. All details of walks, events and attractions mentioned on this trail can be found on visitbristol.co.uk or from the tourist information centres around the city. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the tour.
Drink and the devil had done for the rest.